Today, the first in a little series about the Psalms climbing the hill of God.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Rather than taking a break from the Psalms, we're going to take a break in the Psalms. I would be moving on to Psalms, I think, 95 and 96 and following in order if I were going just in numerical order. But for the summer, my producer, Daisy, you know, the person everyone asks me about, she thought it would be a good idea for us to do something a little different and just study some of the Psalms of Ascent. So she picked out a list on her own of certain Psalms of Ascent that she thought would be relevant for the summer. She has no real reason to think this, but anyway, that's a joke. Of course she does. The point is, she gave me a list of the Psalms and just said, maybe pick five of these, and we'll do those for the other episodes that we have this summer. The other episodes in series, by the way, were the ones we did interviewing the vice presidents for the college, which I really enjoyed doing, and hearing some of their stories that I had not heard before. It was a lot of fun. So anyway, now we're on to the Psalms of Ascent. And so this first one we're going to take is Psalm 121. Now, the Psalms of Ascent amount to the Psalms from 120 to 134 in the canon. And you can see it. I mean, it just says on each one, a song of ascents. And we'll talk about what that means in just a moment. But it makes sense that they would all be tied together. There are a couple, maybe three or four other psalms that are similar that I would think of as songs of ascent. But they're not necessarily titled this way. They don't have that superscript on them. I'm not going back to those. I think Psalm 48 was one that Daisy had looked up and mentioned. And also we saw Psalm 24. And there were a couple of others that are similar to this. And they're certainly written in the same context, regardless of whether they actually fit the little body of Songs of Ascent that we'll be looking at. But the first one we're going to do is Psalm 121. You'll be familiar with it. As soon as I start reading it, I will lift up my eyes to the hills from whence cometh my help. My help comes from the Lord. That psalm is the one we're going through today. And we're going to take it a phrase at a time, really one couplet at a time, two verses or so at a time, in order to understand it, because it flows very naturally, very simply, straightforward, and is beautiful. It does carry some excellent things in it. I love these psalms. They're probably my favorite set of psalms in terms of the beauty that's inherent to them, but that didn't make them my favorite. They became my favorites because when you understand the context within which they practically have to be understood, in which you have to see them happening, then it really brings them alive in a way that's, well, it's just a different challenge in the other Psalms. They're all different. Like when we were looking at the earlier Psalms and we look at David when he's fleeing Absalom, for instance, or consider David because of what he's doing with Saul at the moment, or how he's handling the dedication of the temple or the tabernacle again and so on, or the Ark of the Covenant and so on. When you look at those things in their context, it really changes the psalm. It brings them to life. These all have that same kind of value to them, but not in the third person sense. They're very direct in a very strong sense, exactly the same thing we should be thinking as we're reading the Psalms, because of why they're referred to as songs of ascent. These are the songs that people would sing as they're climbing the steps. That's what the ascent is. And it doesn't matter that it's the steps rather than the hill. That's the point. I said climbing the hill of God. It's traveling from your hometown to Jerusalem, or traveling in Jerusalem up to the Temple Mount, or traveling on the temple up to where the sacrifices would be offered. But it's climbing into the presence of God in this congregational context, this sense of going to the place where people worship together. And so in this context, definitely, I mean, it's about being on the way to the temple, which is why you could look back at some of those earlier psalms that we did and see the same kind of setting for us to consider. But what I want you to take into consideration, and because this is the first one, I'll take an extra minute on this, is the cultural context that this would have for the people who were singing it, you know, when these psalms were first presented to them. Here's the song you should sing as you approach the hill of God today. And so they would come singing this psalm. I just want to put it in that context. And in that context, then apply it directly to us, because we also come to the hill of God. We may not have to climb up to Jerusalem. You may not have to drive uphill both ways in the snow to your church. But you do ascend the mountain of God. You do approach the holy place where you meet with God and his people. And there's a sense in which this language, this metaphor, which was literal for them because Jerusalem is on a mountain, and the Temple Mount is the highest place in Jerusalem in their way of describing it, and so on. Even though it's not just metaphorical for them, the metaphor carries over to us. We are ascending into the presence of God when we come to worship. And so when we start to take this into context, a song of ascents, a song for those who are about to approach the presence of God with his people, then you consider it in several different lights. Number one, and these are not entirely different from each other. They are entangled with each other in a good way. They're intertwined naturally. But one of those ways is simply to recognize as the people of God that you're going into the presence of God. And in this case, you know, when we're looking at it in the Old Testament, and I'm looking at a Bible in front of me when I'm saying this, so I'm pointing at a scripture. When we're looking at it like this in the scriptures and seeing it, you know, as it would be sung by someone in Hebrew in the Old Testament era, then you mean Israel, the people of Israel who had become a people in that land through all the struggles they had gone through and now have this central place of worship where they can gather as they were commanded to do. It provides a context for you to understand people singing this song. So don't get this wrong, because you certainly couldn't replace it with these. But in the same way we think about patriotic songs, or we think about songs that tie us together as a common people, just a common people. And so that those people received their covenant, their instruction, the fathers had given them a statement about what it was to be the people of God that culminates in having this central place of worship. And then they bundle up and they go toward this place of worship, singing these songs together. And so when I say their fathers, you know, Abraham, Moses, when you get to Moses in particular, it's articulated. It's spelled out in words. So I'll give you the example from the second telling of the law, you know, when he's actually lecturing the people because he's about to die or be carried away by God, and he wants them to go into the land, keeping in mind who they actually are. In Deuteronomy 12, not long after, by the way, he has just given them the Shema and said, this is what you want to remind your family of. I'll get to that next. As a people, as the people of Israel, as the people who are the nation of God, he says in Deuteronomy 12, you shall destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess served their gods on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. You shall tear down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and burn their Asherim. Keep that word in mind. We'll come back to it later on as we're talking through this psalm. Their Asherim, you know, these idolatrous places where you could worship Ishtar and Ashtaroth, as it's said. With fire, he says, you destroy all of that, and you chop down the carved images of their gods and destroy their name out of that place. You shall not worship Yahweh, your God, in that way, but you shall seek the place that Yahweh, your God, will choose out of all your tribes to put his name and make his habitation there. And they didn't know where that was going to be yet. It's not like Jerusalem existed as Jerusalem. It's, you know, Jebus occupied by completely different people at this time. It becomes David's city much later. So anyway, the point is, Moses is saying, you know, whatever place it is that God chooses for you to use, that's where you'll make his habitation there. There you shall go, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and the contribution that you present, your vow offerings, your free will offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. And there you shall eat before Yahweh, your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your households, in all that you undertake, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. The whole point is that these songs of ascent are them acting as the people that God made them when they went into the land where he established their covenant with them and said, you're going to have one place to come and worship me. And this is how you're going to know you're my people, because you're not going to worship all over the place at the top of every hill and every god that you can set up or every idol you can set up on the tops of those hills. Instead, you're going to come to my house. And so when we start reading a psalm like Psalm 121, a song of ascent, we need to see God's people leaving their home and filling up their wagon with the stores or the supplies and trailing their animals that they're going to offer in sacrifice and coming as the people of God to fulfill the not just the commandment, but the invitation that he had given them to be his people. So as a people, we have the songs of ascent, and then we have it as families. And as I read this to you, the reason I'm reading this next section to you, again, from the second telling of the law, from Deuteronomy, is because of the family inclination that it has to it. But the reason I'm saying this is so important is because as a people, they didn't just pass down the traditions when they gathered in the congregation at the temple and heard the priest declare things. They also passed it down personally within their family. So the family became part of passing down the heritage of God from one generation to the next. And the telling of that is in Deuteronomy 6. It's the most famous passage, the Shema, where he gives them what the Shema is. And then after he does that, you know, the Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. That whole statement, and you shall love the Lord your God. That whole statement leads into this passage about how they're supposed to pass this down from one generation to the next. And he says in that passage, Deuteronomy 6:20, when your son asks you in time to come, what's the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you'll say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders great and grievous against Egypt and brought us out from there that he might bring us in and give us the land that he swore to give to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are this day. And it will be righteousness for us if we're careful to do all this commandment before the Lord our God as he commanded us. That whole statement is God saying, when your son asks, when the people over whom God has given you responsibility and authority, both, come to you and say, what are we doing? Pass down the heritage to them of what it means to be my people. And so bundling up your possessions and your goods and your sacrifices, all of those things to go with you to the temple was one part of the picture. But the other part of the picture was taking your household, taking the people who were a part of your family to go and to make this observance before God for our sake, to remember who we are, but also to understand who he is, the one to whom we've been committed and the one who's committed himself to us. And so in one sense, it is sort of spiritually, I guess you could say, you know, as the people of God and as a family who are committed to being a part of the people of God. In another sense, there's just a human nature to the song of ascent. There's something built into going toward the temple that's just human. And I don't mean by this that all religions are equal and they're all just equally, mystical expressions of human nature. And Hebraic tradition is no different than Hinduistic tradition or something like that. I'm not saying that. But there are common elements in it. And why wouldn't there be? God creates all human beings, no matter what their religion becomes. And the fact that a true religion can fulfill that wouldn't mean it has no similarities to other religions. So when I say this, I'm not compromising my commitment to Judeo-Christian religion or to Christianity specifically. But there is a value in a song of ascent that supersedes or at least goes beyond. That's really what I mean. It goes beyond the limitations of the understanding you would have to have as a person who actually is redeemed and has been made part of the people of God. It's just built into being human. There's a narrative part that goes with that, which I'll put back into the Judaic tradition, just the Hebraic tradition, and our Christian tradition, which we would see as Eden. Narratively, we need a place that we go that returns us to where we were supposed to be to begin with. And I know people do all these excursions to figure out where Eden was, and isn't it a shame there was a flood and now we don't know where the real Eden was and all that kind of stuff. And if you love doing that, more power to you, whatever. But the narrative, I really dismissed that, didn't I? I'm not trying to be rude about it. I just am being rude about it. I sincerely am happy with somebody doing that, and I don't know whether the answer would come back factually when we get to heaven and say, God, by the way, where was Eden to begin with? And he says, you would never have imagined. It was in Tennessee. No, whatever. You know, I don't know what the answer would be. He can answer whatever he wants, and it could be whatever he wants it to be. But narratively, it's not complicated. It's Jerusalem. That's Eden. The whole land of Israel is Eden. Remember, there's a garden in the midst of Eden. So the whole nature of the telling of the story is to get us from the garden back to the garden. And when we go back to the garden, the tree is even there. Everything is there. And it's in the New Jerusalem, which we're supposed to associate with Jerusalem. So it's not, you know, it's not narratively, it's not complicated at all. Geographically, I don't know how that relates. I don't know whether it relates. I don't know what all that is. The flood changes a lot of things, right? But whatever. The point is, narratively, we go back to Eden. And that's not just true for Hebrews or for Christians in the New Testament. It's just human nature. That's how we tell stories. It's how we understand stories because it's how we are as human beings. If you sense a disruption, which is what makes a story what it is, if you sense a disruption, it means you want somehow to resolve that. Resolution means basically going back to the state you had before the disruption. It doesn't mean nothing's changed. It doesn't mean there's nothing different. Obviously, the New Jerusalem is not the same as the Old Jerusalem. I get that. But the point is, you go back where you were. So a song of ascent has a nature built into it that says, I'm doing more than leaving my homestead to go to the central feature of our nation or to the central place of worship for our religion. It's something that says, I'm going back to the place where I find out who I really am. Who was I from the beginning, and who am I supposed to be when things are done? Where did you come from? Where are you going? Those are always the two questions we're supposed to answer. And we answer those by climbing the hill of God, by following these songs of ascent. So narratively, we wouldn't be surprised by the significance that comes with climbing the hill of climbing the hill of God. But then also psychologically, there's a component to this. There is and this is, I say psychologically, I'm not saying that like a psychologist would say it. I mean it like an anthropologist would say it. Our minds work in a certain way, and this also has to do with the way we tell stories and so, but it's more just the nature of being human that we demarcate things that are profane, things that are mundane, things that are outside the realm of our control, the chaos, the wildness that's out there. Even just saying it's out there as making part of the picture, that's the stuff that's in the perimeter, on the perimeter. But then there's the center, and that's where we have warmth and home and where we have found the old village that we were a part of or the town center or even better, the little fence around the home place where we're supposed to be and the hearth inside of that. You know, when you finally get to the very center, that's where you're at peace. And this is very clearly Jerusalem. The pictures of Jerusalem are very clearly about climbing the hill of God to that sacred center, that place where everything is made right again. And you'll see some more of that in the language of this psalm as well. And if you say, man, you're reading a lot of stuff back into these Psalms, and it seems like it's anachronistic, and you're just taking a lot of Western ideas and putting these back in. You actually have the telling of this quite backwards. We develop our poetry and our understanding of the language around our translations of Scripture. And so those images are not something, you know, we have to read back into Scripture. They're things that became central to our way of writing and describing and telling stories, because the stories that we built our culture around are scriptural stories. And aside from that, the psychological component and the narrative component is built into human nature also. But I don't need to read anything back into it. I just need to recognize that, man, a lot of the images that we value most in our society, that we value most in the movies we love or the novels we read or the great literature that we embrace, those are images that are built into these Psalms. I mean, built into the heart of these Psalms, so you can understand why they would be so appealing. Okay, so all that said, let's look at Psalm 121 itself. And I'll read it to you real quickly. It's super short, 8 verses, and it comes in, they're in pairs. The last 4 do go together, and the first 4 do go together, but they're really built into pairs. So a song of ascents. I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord. This is Yahweh, the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Then we start verse 3, the second section. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord, we start the third section, starting in verse 5. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The last section, the Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. And that's the whole psalm. That's the whole thing. So what I want to do is just take that psalm 2 verses at a time and kind of talk through where it takes us. The first 2 verses really take us to God the Creator. That's what they're about, God being the Creator. It's not the whole message of the first 2 verses, but it is the context within which we have to hear them and understand them. And especially think about it as we look at these first 2 verses. Think about it in the context of singing these psalms, maybe with your family, with your friends, with your neighborhood, whoever are all traveling to Jerusalem or climbing up the Temple Mount to get to the temple together and singing these songs together on the way. Sort of like, you know, 101 psalms on the wall, right? Take one down, pass it around, 100 psalms on the wall, right? Hey, it's better than the alternative, right? Okay, so anyway, because they would have sung these songs together going. So here's the song. I lift up my eyes to the hills. This is where they're going. They're literally looking at the hills that they're climbing while they're saying, I lift up my eyes to the hills. And then I ask a question, or if you're translating in the King James, you're making a statement. From whence comes my help? I lift up my eyes to those hills, and that's where my help comes from. Or, if you ask it as a question, as the ESV translates it, I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? The word help becomes really important here for obvious reasons. I'll explain in just a second. Verse 2 begins this way. My help, it repeats, comes from Yahweh, who made heaven and earth. So just 3 or 4 things to point out in those 2 verses. Number 1, you know, they're climbing a hill to Jerusalem. If you think of all the holy places that you recognize, especially in our culture, Western culture, they're steepled places. We put steeples on them because they reach up to the heavens. They reach up to the sky, and they declare, this is a place where you can connect heaven and earth. And in fact, sacred places throughout history, not just in Hebrew culture or Western culture, but throughout the world, sacred places are generally places where you have ascents, something that takes you up to heaven, which, again, in image form is a steeple or something like that, or it can just be a tall tower, whatever it is, or it can just be the top of a mountain like the Pythia. But wherever there's an ascent, but also a descent, meaning there is a cave or a way to go down into the ground as well, which there was at the Pythia in Greece I'm talking about. So the sacred places are always like that because they connect heaven with earth. They connect the world above with the world below and all of that coming out, flowing into this world where we live. So holiness imbues the world from this place, on the good side from above and on the dark side from below, where life is bestowed from above and death is realized below. All of those places come together in the sacred places. So climbing the hill of God, obviously, is an invitation for us to see Jerusalem itself, to see the Temple Mount itself as this high, exalted place where we can meet with God in the heavens. So there is first Jerusalem as a steeple itself. And Jerusalem is a sacred place. By the way, all of that language is used about Jerusalem throughout the scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament. There is an ascent to Jerusalem. It's on the hill. It's Mount Zion. It's the great hill of the north. It's higher than all the other mountains in the earth. And obviously, they're not saying that literally geographically about the height above sea level, but about how God is great. Our God is great. And so this mountain is the greatest mountain because that's where the great God resides. And it's in figure form in the temple, but it's an important figure. So anyway, where there is an ascent in Jerusalem, but also where there is a descent, which is why the Valley of Kidron and the place called Gehenna becomes what it is. The Valley of, you know, Hinnom, which becomes Gehenna, which becomes this label for, you know, the lake of fire, the place where people face their eternal condemnation in the depths below. That place where they literally burned trash after idols had been worshipped there for generations and probably centuries becomes the depth, becomes the pit that's compared with the ascent of Jerusalem itself. Jerusalem, this place where the heights of heaven meet the depths below the earth. And so as this person ascends into the heavens, there's no focus on the depths here. There's no focus on the pit. There's the focus on the person who's on the earth trying to ascend into the heavens. We're not trying to get to the pit or to where death is. So a song of ascent would not be about the pit side of this story. So the statements, my help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth, become particularly important. Now, the second thing to say about this is, first of all, recognizing I'm lifting up my eyes to the hills because I am ascending to the place where I'm going to be able to meet with God. The second is that the first verse ends with exactly the same word that begins the second verse. So from whence comes my help is the end of the first verse. And then the answer comes, my help comes from the Lord. That anadiplosis is what it's called. It's a repetition. It's just a reduplication of words. But this duplication of the words, my help, is immediate, and it's broken by punctuation at the end of one sentence, at the beginning of the next sentence, to make emphatic that that's what we're talking about. My help is what I'm looking for, and my help is what's provided here. So the end of verse 1 to the beginning of verse 2 puts a real focus on how we are ascending the hill of God because we need help. And that's where we're going to find it. So I'm climbing the hill of God because I need to arrive at the person who's present on the hill of God. Third point, observation to make about these first two verses. My help comes from the Lord. Using the word comes is just so mundane, so common, we just kind of pass over it. It's just going. And it is a common word. It's like the word do for us. It just, you know, so what comes next? We're not thinking of that as in an action sort of sense. But there is actually a verb inserted here so that it's not just a place filler for it came from somewhere. It's actually saying my help needs to arrive. It needs to enter. And in this case, my help enters. My help arrives from somewhere. And it comes from Yahweh, who is on that hill that I'm climbing. I'm not saying literally. Solomon knows that. Israel knows that. But figuratively, you come to the temple because it is the dwelling place for Yahweh that you consider as a people of God. And the coming means my help is going to arrive. My help is going to take a step out of the temple to come and meet me where I'm coming to meet him. So that's the third part. Fourth part in the first two verses that I want to mention is this, and this is the key part that leads to the rest of the psalm. My help comes from Yahweh. And the way it's translated is who made heaven and earth, which makes it a verb. It is a verb. The word made is a verb, is what I'm saying. But the word is in Hebrew, it's a participle, and I'm not trying to give a grammar lesson, just real brief notice, because this matters in the next two verses. It's a participle, meaning it's been made into an adjective or a noun in the way the author uses it. So it's not just my help comes from the Lord. From the Lord who made heaven and earth. He made heaven and earth. It's not that. It's who made heaven and earth is the maker of heaven and earth. So of heaven and earth, he is the maker. And that's his nature. It's about him being the maker. Now, I'm not saying that because it changes the fact that it means he made heaven and earth. It means the same thing. The translation's just Jim Dandy. No problem with it whatsoever. But the fact that he didn't just happen to make heaven and earth, he is the maker of heaven and earth today. So as I approach Yahweh, I don't approach somebody who's just finished with something. I approach someone who still is the one who made the heavens and the earth. And again, the translation gets that across. Who made heaven and earth? He's the one. It's about him. So this maker of heaven and earth is the person I'm coming to meet on the ascent. So he makes the heavens toward which I am ascending as I'm reading this psalm, as I'm praying or singing this psalm. We're climbing toward the heavens. Who made that? He did, the maker of heaven and earth. And where is it that I'm needing the help from? I'm on the earth. I'm on the ground. I'm walking the soil. So as I'm walking the earth toward the heavens, I'm wondering where my help is going to arrive from, and it's going to arrive from the maker of the heavens I am approaching and the earth on which I stand now. That's a beautiful invitation to find comfort before I've even gotten to the answer that's in this psalm in the first two verses. Those are the first two verses. Starting the third verse, there's a really just fantastic transition that happens, and now everything is going to change to focus on one word. It's one of the first words you learn. If you take just basic Hebrew, you learn this word shamar because it's super easy to parse and to figure out how to transfer the shape of the verb into the forms that mean all these different things. And so everybody who studies Hebrew learns the word shamar. And it's used throughout the rest of the psalm, and it means guard, watch, or keep. And we'll talk about all those meanings in just a moment. I mean, we'll talk about how they're used in this psalm in just a moment. You'll see. So starting in verse 3, here's the second section of the psalm. And the transition, just so you can hear it before I start reading it, the transition now is not to talk about God as the maker, but to talk about God as the keeper, God as the sustainer of those heavens and earths, right? Of the heavens and the earth. So God as the sustainer. Here he is, verse 3. He will not let your foot be moved. This is for people who are climbing a hill right now, by the way. What a perfect statement. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you. And again, it's a participle. Again, the translation's fine. It's not like we lose it because of the translation. I just want to point out, it literally is shomrecha. It's just one word. It is your keeper. One word, though. Your keeper will not slumber. He's not going to fall asleep. He who keeps you will not slumber. And then the same kind of reduplication, the same kind of duplication takes place that took place between verses 1 and 2. Not anadiplosis, because it's not immediately restated in the very next words, but the repetition becomes obvious. He who keeps Israel. First it was he who keeps you. Now it is the keeper of Israel, right? So not shomrecha, but the Shomer of Israel. Okay, so he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. And again, it's not because there's a magical difference between slumbering and sleeping, but because they want to be so emphatic about saying he's not dozing off, he's not taking the night off, he is constantly guarding, keeping, sustaining, not just the world, he is the one who made the world, but he's keeping you. He's keeping Israel. He cares about you. So your keeper in verse 3, becoming keeper of Israel in verse 4, which, by the way, in this case, it ends both verses. That word, even though the translation doesn't put it this way, that word is the last word in each of those verses. In verse 3, the last word is keeper, and in verse 4, the last word is keeper of Israel. Israel is the last word put together with the keeper of. So the keeper of you and the keeper of Israel ends both of these verses. That idea also points out the difference between these two verses and verses 1 and 2, which is, I mean, it's sort of built into it. But again, we so personalize these psalms, we make them so uniquely about us personally, that we don't always see or hear when there's an antiphonal change, you know, when there's a chorus that responds and gives an answer. Like when I read it myself, to myself, in a prayer, for instance, I just think in the first two verses, I'm saying it about myself. Oh, I'm just talking to myself. And then in the second, in the end of it, I'm talking to myself, but I'm saying it to myself as you. So I'm talking to my soul like David does in some of his psalms. But in this case, it's literally a song of approaching the temple in congregational worship. And I think we ought to hear it antiphonally. And the fact that it has at the end of it a benediction, words to send people out of the temple to say, now you can go and know that it's okay, that God is going with you, means that we should hear this as a chorus responding. So in verses 3 and 4 here, you actually have the congregation responding and saying, well, your keeper is this person. You're asking for help. You have better than help. I'll explain why that is in just a moment, why this is better. But you have better than help. You have a keeper, someone who's watching over you all the time. So you replace you replace the my with your by the time you get to verses 3 and 4. And the participles, again, I'm mentioning these, you know, the creator, the maker in verses 1 and 2 becomes the keeper, the sustainer in verses 3 and 4. So he doesn't create the heavens and the earth, you know, the maker of heaven and earth. He doesn't create the heavens and earth and then go to sleep. And then maybe we need to wake up God so that he'll pay attention to us. And in the Psalms themselves, we're given that language. Lord, how long until you see? Wake up, O God. Please avenge us of our adversaries. We've heard those prayers over and over again. This, in coming to the scene of worship, where we see God's presence among his people, is where he reminds us that even though those prayers make sense, that's why he gives us Psalms to pray them. The truth behind it all is that God didn't create the world and then go to sleep. He not only made the world, he also keeps the world. And not just the world, but you. He keeps Israel. He hasn't just got a general sense of well-being for the whole of it on average, and sorry about your loss, but hey, at least this guy's better off than he was before. No, for you, he cares. And the only time, by the way, I'm going to mention this very briefly in passing, but you get this as a major theme of the New Testament. The only problem with that is if you hear it and think it's uniquely about you, which is exactly what Israel did, because God makes it so specifically about them. He keeps Israel. They thought, well, surely he doesn't keep Moab then. Surely he doesn't keep Egypt then. Not recognizing that God was sanctifying Israel because he wanted to sanctify Egypt and Assyria and Babylon, which Jonah learns when he goes to Nineveh about the Assyrians as well. So in all of those things, so what we're supposed to learn is what Jesus is doing when he describes God as our keeper and says he knows when a sparrow falls. What we're not supposed to say is, God doesn't care about us at all. He cares about you personally. What we're also not supposed to say is, well, I know he cares about me personally, but not about those wicked people. We're supposed to realize that he cares about a bird that falls, that he cares about a hair that falls from our head, as Jesus puts it in the New Testament. So you get that point. But all of that should be saying to us, I don't have to wonder if God cares about me. So the antiphonal nature of it is, that we're climbing the mountain saying, I'm coming to God for help. I'm trying to climb the mountain of God. And my feet are in these slippery places, and I'm hoping I get there. And the antiphonal voices from above in worship look down at you and say, he's watching. He will keep you. It's the value of congregational worship. It's the whole point of us being in church on Sundays. And it begs for those of us, those of you, and I'm so blessed with a congregation that does this. I show up and I see hands reaching down and I see people looking out and saying, it's okay, he sees you, he cares about you, I am here to take your hand. It is a reason for you to reconsider what you're doing if you're in a toxic environment. If you go to church and leave not having heard the voice of God's people saying to you, you're safe here. it's okay. God cares about what you're going through. Then you really need to reevaluate what you're doing in congregational worship, because that's why he's always brought his people together. And it is a way also for you to think of your own role in the church. You are a comer. You're the one who's climbing, and you need to see someone reaching down to you and saying, come up, it's safe. God is here, and this is where you'll find him. But you also need to be a receiver. You need to join the congregation's voice and say to those who are coming in the door, yeah, it's safe. Come in, come in. This is a great place to worship Yahweh. Those are the first four verses. The last four verses honestly won't take as long. I know you doubt me on this. Daisy certainly doubts that I can do this. But the last four verses are not as complicated. They're very straightforward. The others aren't complicated. But, you know, they're woven with beauty. You have to talk about them. So looking at verses 5 and 6, there is the first part of this close. This close is all a benediction. So, and the first part is just that God sustains constantly. So we see God as the sustainer. The word keeper is going to continue to be used. It's used six times in these verses, the end of the psalm, verses 3 through verse 8. It's just used constantly, repeatedly. So he's the keeper, and he's constantly the keeper. That's these two verses. The Lord is your keeper. There it is used again. The Lord is your, and then he uses this word to describe what it means for God to be our keeper. He is our shade, because he's going to use a metaphor about the lights that rule the day and the night. So the sun shall not strike you by day, nor shall the moon strike you by night. Again, the psalm actually just says, the sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. So in verse 5, the word your keeper is repeated again from the end of verse 3, exactly the way that it was given to us at the end of verse 3, and it'll be brought up again in verse 7 also, and by the way, it's also in verse 8, but with a tiny little change in verse 8 that we'll bring up. But now, and in verse 7, it is Yahweh Shomrecha. It is the Lord your keeper. He's the one who's keeping you. So it's made very personal, not just on your side, he's your keeper, but now his name is being attached to it. Yahweh your keeper. It's as if one of the names of God is Yahweh, your keeper. That's a very powerful and personal statement. And then in verse six, when it says, the sun will not strike you by day, nor the moon by night, I'll try to do this briefly. A couple of the best options that I think for understanding this, and I think both are actually sort of implied. Poetry has a lot of ambiguity to it, and it should. It makes it richer, more powerful. You can see the sun and moon as lesser deities, not meaning there are actually other gods, but you know how they talk about the demons in the New Testament being the false gods of the Old Testament. So whatever those spiritual beings are, the way the cultures describe them, the nations describe them, or spiritually as demons, whatever it is, those false gods, you know, that other nations worship and bring against Israel, they could be the object here, where they're saying Yahweh isn't asleep. And so you don't have to fear the Egyptian god Ra of the sun, Ray, sometimes people say, Ra, Ray, of the sun, which is the root, by the way, to the name Ramses, which is just Moses attached to the sun god, Ra, Moses, Ramses. It's the same name. It's the Egyptian name. This is, they worshipped Ra, that's the sun god. And that's who they had been fleeing when they were leaving Egypt. And God says, no, I'm watching over you. I will protect you. There's this flame over you at night that you can see. You can see the pillar of cloud by day. You know that I am with you. So you don't have to fear the sun by day or the Assyrian god, Ishtar, Ashtaroth, the Asherah poles, all the things that they used in worship in those days, Assyrian, the Babylonian tradition, which was the daughter of the moon. You don't have to fear the sun or the moon. Maybe it's a reference in their world, in their minds, to the lesser deities, these other nations. I don't have to fear what's coming from them. Maybe terrible things come from them. Maybe slaughters come from them. But Yahweh knows, and he's my keeper, and he hasn't fallen asleep. Or it could just be this universal, pervasive statement of God's watching over them day and night. After all, in Genesis, you know, he creates the great lights, the greater light, the sun to rule the day, and the lesser light, the moon to rule the night, and sets them over the day and the night to say everything is ruled over, in which case this verse would stand as sort of a merism. You know, we're going to name the extremes all the way from the sun to the moon. Every minute is covered of the day. And so all of night and day is safe because we're in God's hands. So God sustains constantly. That's the idea in verses 5 and 6. And then in verses 7 and 8, he's sustaining in every possible way. Yahweh will keep you from all evil, all of it. He will keep your life. That's your soul. He keeps your life substance, right? He will keep your nefesh. So he keeps your life. And hear how often he's saying this. Yahweh keeps. Yahweh is the keeper. And he's actually doing it in these verbally. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. Why is he doing that? Because he's the keeper. This is what he does. He guards, he keeps, he watches over us. And so he keeps you from all evil. He keeps your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. If I were to try to summarize the content here, you know, of in every possible way, to go back to the times that were being talked about in verses 5 and 6, from this time forth and forevermore, the this time forth is, you know, this time is while they were at the temple. They were in a sacred space. They would expect the Lord to keep them there, to watch them there. So on the way to the temple or in that sacred space, they can expect God to keep them. But this is from this time forth and forevermore. So it's also all times, the mundane times, when you get back to your house, in your village, when you're working out in your field. He doesn't just help. I lift up my eyes to the hills and ask, where does my help come from? He doesn't just help. He keeps, he guards, he watches over all of the time. So verses 5 through 8 become not just this welcome, your request has been heard, come into the congregation. It is that, especially in verses 3 and 4. But verses 5 through 8 are not simply God responding and saying, your request has been heard, I will help you, but instead a benediction to everyone who belongs to Yahweh, to every person who belongs to God, a benediction that says, let me send you out with something you ought to keep in mind, which is how I'll send you out from this episode, with just the words of Psalm 121, verses 5 through 8. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade right in your hand. The sun will not be able to strike you when you go out by day. The moon will never find you if it looks for you at night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your whole life. The Lord will keep your going out. He will keep your coming in. He will watch over it when you are going out. He will watch over your life when you are coming in from this day forth forever. Amen.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.